Hello, and welcome to the Cannon Fodder Podcast. I'm so glad that you have joined us today. I, of course, am film critic Daniel Barnes. Disgraced, graced, I don't know, under Edward Yang's lens, I think we're all a little graced. Even me, the most disgraced among us all. With me, as always, the ye to my knee. Of course, it's Corky McDonald.
What's up, Dan? How you doing?
I'm doing all right. You know what? You say ye where others say knee.
Mm.
And that doesn't make any sense.
I am a knight.
You're the, one of the knights who say ye.
Yeah.
So rare among us. Quirky, I got some fun facts for you. Do you love fun facts?
Dan, I love facts, be they fun, be they morose,
right.
Be they...
Right, like, you know, I'm always here for an unfun fact. I'm always here to just fill you with the most boring, uninteresting facts that you can possibly imagine. But a fun fact, well, that's pretty fun. Well, you know, we randomly select the movies on the show. We have a random number generator, we have a numbered list, and whatever boop is picked.
Dan, I already knew this. This is not new information.
That's the movie. No, that's not a fun, like what I said.
That's not the fun
That's
fact.
An unfun fact. That's a very boring, uninteresting fact that you probably already knew. Like, <it's> nothing. I've been true to form, giving you both sides. But Corky, that randomness maybe is not always so random, or is it?
Wait.
Yes, it isn't. Question mark? Exclamation point? Semicolon? Here's a fun fact. Quirky, My Darling Clementine. That was two episodes ago. John Ford's Great Western, now in the Cannon Fodder canon officially. That film was released in 1946. It was also episode 46.
What?
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty fun.
Yeah.
And if nothing else, it's a good lotto number for you.
It's quirky.
I mean, I'm feeling 46 for whatever. Mm-hmm. That's lucky. Okay, just know that. All right. But how about some fun facts about Edward Yang? That's the director of the film we'll be reviewing this week. Edward Yang, he was born in China. His family fled to Taiwan when he was a toddler, even younger than the toddler and than the kid in this movie. Eventually came to America to study electrical engineering. He got his master's from the University of Florida. Go Gators. Briefly attended USC Film School. Go Trojans. But that was not his world. You know, Edward Yang, now that this was my first Edward Yang movie. Actually, I'd never seen Yi before. And now that I know him, he's not a USC film. He doesn't want to direct, McDonald's commercials and episodes of Full House. That's why you go to USC Film School, to just be a professional. So he went back to the tech world. He was in Seattle for a while. Then he saw a film. It was a film that inspired him to take film back up, basically inspired him to become a filmmaker. Do you want to know what that movie was?
Was it The Package with Tommy Lee Jones and Gene Hackman?
That is, God, like, so close. That was number two. I think that was the second film that he saw. Number one film that he saw... Agira, the Wrath of God. That's the movie we reviewed on our last episode. I mean, this is like a ridiculous coincidence right there between two movies that seem to have nothing to do with each other, right? Like opposite sides of the world, opposite genres, opposite everything. But I just thought that was absolutely fascinating. I think if you can find a connection, maybe it's this idea that like you can make an epic movie that is not expensive. You know what I mean? Like you can make an intimate, epic movie that is not a blockbuster. You know what I mean? So
right.
Like Yi Yi is epic in its own way, in its own sort of intimate, small scale sort of a way. And maybe that was the idea that he got, because his previous film is the 4 hour long, A Brighter Summer Day. So he loved a long movie, Edward Yang.
Sure.
But yeah, amazing connection between Agira and Yi Yi. Who saw it coming? Couple of the year.
That's amazing. That is a fun fact.
Mm-hmm. I thought
it is a fact. I had fun while you were telling me that.
We were telling. Have fun telling it to other people from now on. Although
those
it wouldn't really make
kind of
any
facts.
Sense except just in the context of the show. So I don't know if that would be fun.
You know what else is fun? thanking our PayPal donators.
Oh man, that's the epitome of fun.
I want every Fuck PayPal supporter listening right now, go put on your silly glasses. Me and Dan both have ours on. These are our party glasses.
Trust us.
I've got my badge that says Captain Fun of the Fun Police. And we're going to take a moment to say thank you, PayPal supporters. You're the donors. You're the heroes of the show. We couldn't do it without you. And we thank you all, each individually, for your fantastic financial support.
It's interesting that you're Captain Fun of the Fun Police. So the Fun Police is a private a security firm. This is what you're saying. This is not publicly funded. I thought they were actual cops, the Fun Police. I honestly thought that. But this is a private security firm people hire to have fun, prevent fun. How do you roll, Captain?
I'm so glad we're talking about this finally, because that is a common misconception. No, we're from the city of Fun, Pennsylvania. And it's a small constabulary, but there's three diligent officers, and we all take turns rotating who gets captain each year. And this year, I'm Captain Fun of the Fun Police.
That's awesome. That's
currently amazing. Outside of my jurisdiction by about 3,000 miles.
Really? Yeah. Really? None of this? So this is all extra legal, this podcast. None of this is legal.
I'm doing it on public time.
Wait, too. Are you wearing a wire?
Yes, but it's silly string because we're the Fun Police.
I love the Fun Police. I also love the supporters of our show. Don't you, Quirky?
I love them so much. I'd marry them, one of them, if I could.
If you would like to be one of those people who we love just so goddamn much, head over to daredaniel.com.
If you'd like to get married.
Find the menu. Let's do it. I don't know. What are the marriage laws like in Fun, Pennsylvania?
Same as Utah.
Let's go. Let's get wild. Let's do this.
There's Mennonites. Yes, there is in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Anyway. If you'd like to be part of this covenant marriage, head over to daredaniel.com. Find menu at the top of the page. Click support the show. There's a donate button on the homepage. You can make a one-time donation, a monthly donation. I think you can make a yearly donation. I don't know. Like, if you're really thinking that far ahead, like, you know what? Next year.
Just set it, forget it.
About this much, right? Set it and forget it. Ideally, forget it, really.
But set it, ideally.
Set it for sure. And then, you know, if you ever subscribe to one of those apps that tells you about subscriptions that are on go, What is that? Why is that helping you? How does that help? But any contribution does help keep this show going. Thank you ever so much.
Speaking of going, we're going right into our review of today's movie, Edward Yang's 2000, Yi Yi. The IMDb synopsis for Yi Yi: portrait of a middle-class family in Taipei. A man in his 40s, his teenage daughter, and his 8-year-old son experience life, navigating between remorse, hope, and disappointment.
As far as IMDb synopses go, that one is actually pretty on the money for a movie as complex as Yi. They experience life. You know, right? They experience life. They really do. Written and directed by Edward Yang, Yi Yi. Yang was one of the leading figures in the Taiwanese new wave of the 1980s, along with Hu Xiaoshen, Tsai Ming-liang, and others. Yang, he only made 7 films, and Yi Yi was his 7th and final film. The title means a 1 and a 2, not in the Lawrence Welk sense of on and the two, and but one by one, one after another. He died, Yang did about 7 years after making this film, at age 59. And again, love to hear stories of men in their 50s and their bodies just turning to complete shit as I am turning 50 in this next year. Just inspiring stuff. The piano pieces here are performed by Yang's wife, Kai Li Peng, and they're actually both in the film. They play the cellist and the pianist in the concert scene. Yi Yi premiered May 14, 2000 at the Cannes Film Festival, where Yang won the award for Best Director, and the acclaim only escalated from there. Wasn't any kind of hit, but it has consistently, since it came out, really since its premiere over 25 years ago, it has consistently placed and placed high on best films of the year, best films of the decade, best films of the 21st century, and here we go, best films of all time type of lists. Just this last year, it placed 40th on the New York Times list of the best movies of the 21st century, 60th in the Reader's Choice list. Tied at number 90 on this Sight and Sound Best Films of All Time list. Tied it with some of my all-time favorites. So this is like Ugetsu and Earrings of Madame Da and The Leopard. Yang's four-hour-long A Brighter Summer Day, it placed even higher at number 78. And those positions, looking back at 2012, are like very consistent. If anything, they've edged up a bit, but they're both kind of right there in that top 100. So, Corky, going back to our beginning, are you one of the knights who say ye, or are you giving this movie a knee in the groin?
I don't see why those have to be mutually exclusive.
Well, right? You can do both, I guess. Have fun with it.
One of my pet peeves, and it's a ridiculous pet peeve, but I'm a ridiculous man, is You're when ridiculous. People say, Look as a you. Metaphor, or sorry, as a simile, it's a lot like life. And then they'll describe something and say, it's like life. And it's like,
sure.
That's stupid, because everything you ever can possibly conceive or reference is like life, because they're all contained within life. There's nothing you could point to as a reference and say, that's like life. No, that's part of life. No matter how small, no matter how medium, no matter how big. I think Edward Yang... what he was going for, and this is one of the first movies I think I've ever seen where it takes it from the biggest macro overview of life, beginning to end and all the in-betweens. And that's what this movie is. It's a rumination on the events, the small things, the big things, the meaningful things, the firsts, the lasts. And the main thing I think this movie tells you is that no matter how you see life, there's 7, 8, 9 billion other ways to see it. And literally, they're going to have a different viewpoint of you. Like, quite literally, no one can see it exactly how you see it.
Yeah, it's kind of novel, like, in that sense of getting that feeling for seeing from a lot of different perspectives. I just recently read Mrs. Dalloway, and that like kind of flows from perspectives of one character to the other, and people are seen as different, but then depending on the character, some other character is seen in a different light, you know,
either
as a fool or someone very respectable or someone interesting or non-interesting. So yeah, I think it's outstanding in that sense. And apparently the big, we talked about Aguirre, apparently Michelangelo Antonioni was Yang's greatest influence, like early in his career. And I think you can kind of see it here. I haven't seen any of the early Yang. This is the only one I've seen. A little bit you can see it in the compositions and the use of like sound, off-screen sound is like a fantastic usage here. Long takes, use of like there's a remarkable use of reflections here as well. But to me, Renoir... in how he, this sort of deep well of empathy for his characters. No one's really too good or too bad. You know what I mean? They are people who are living life, trying to figure out life, and you think you know something about someone and you don't really, you've only got that little tip of the iceberg. You don't really know them, and maybe you could never really know them.
And even
so, it's
no one's boring and no one's interesting. No one's better than each other. Everybody's story has these like pieces you could never get the full gist of. And the actions of people may look totally different because you don't know what preceded for them or what's going to happen next, where they're going to go next. Reflections play such a huge part. Like you're often seeing through a window. And you're seeing the reflection of what they're seeing or just their reflection, what happens behind someone. And the big thing, another big thing I saw is the beauty of the banal, the beauty of like the commonplaces. So much of this movie takes place in the spaces in between. Like you don't get a big life event or a big piece of news in some grand, beautiful park vista thing. You get it in a hospital corridor. You get a life lesson in a garage on your way to your car to take you to the next spot. It's like it happens in these liminal spaces. And so much of this movie exists there.
Yeah, and that's a
fantastic. It does it beautifully.
Point. Absolutely. What I think is fascinating, though, is like as we're talking about it, it seems like this kind of like sedate sort of character study. And it is that. It is like very observational and it is very like kind of thoughtful and empathetic and all that kind of stuff. But when you really kind of take everything out, lay it on the floor, and then try to cram it all in back into the suitcase, there are like enough plot lines for like three seasons of episodes of any fucking TV show. Yeah. It opens with a wedding. It ends with a funeral. And in between, there is birth. There is murder. There's possibly a suicide. There's at least four, five, maybe more love triangles because we don't know the full picture about some of these things. There's a drunken brawl.
Yeah.
There's outstanding coincidences and bizarre twists of fate. And none of it, like, again, it also is that. It is this, like, kind of serene, thoughtful character study, right? It never feels too rushed. It all feels very natural and observant and very kind of thoughtful. And there's times even when it does threaten to kind of, it could, like, in the wrong hands, this could all go very too cute and too gimmicky, right? Like, all of every, like, there's a lot of quirks. There's a lot of, like, doppelgangers and symbols and talismans, and there's self-referential things going on and talking about film. Fucking A, it all works. It works so damn brilliantly. It's just rich and full. It just is, it feels so lived in.
That's what really struck me was that, like you say, there's so much that could be gimmicky in the wrong hands, and there's a lot of it. It's like, that could become tedious at 90 minutes in the wrong hands, but we get 3 hours of it.
3 hours.
And it fucking works the whole time. There's not a sag. There's not a lag. Whether the characters are alone, whether they're with people, whether they're with people they don't even understand. You're into it the entire time. And I really want to stress the beauty of the banal. Two characters could be sitting in a McDonald's. Two characters could be sitting wistfully at a bar where everybody else is having fun. Not a bar, but a coffee shop where everybody else is having fun, except for them. In a darkened karaoke bar where nobody's having fun, but that's the point of the place is to have fun. Yes. And it's just, man, for a movie that doesn't move fast, it moves with an emotion and clarity. And I respected and loved the hell out of it. Like, it's a long movie, so I wasn't sure if I could get it all in one sit.
Mm-hmm.
But it was another Colonel Blimp situation where I'm like pushing myself. I'm like, come on, I can do another 20. I can do another 20. Let's go.
Go, go, go.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. And it sits, I think, up there with the all-time great wedding scenes to open a film.
Mm.
Right there with The Godfather, Deer Hunter, 50 Shades Freed. All the greats. It's so fun. No, this is just like it just starts right away, and you're just like, you don't have any perspective on like who these characters are or what their lives are or how everyone relates to each other or anything. Like, it all just sort of comes out naturally through the scene, right? No, there's no explanations for it or anything like that. No narration or anything. But you're never really like lost, right?
No.
Even as like you're getting information that you didn't realize like was there all the time.
So. You don't know who these people are, but you know exactly who these people and these situations are. Everybody's been to a wedding where their kids are teasing each other. They're ganging up on the one littlest kid.
It's all so familiar.
Some family members aren't really happy with this wedding and they might not stick around for the whole thing. You know, we're not expressing ourselves correctly. Emotions getting the best of us, whatever the emotions are at these big emotional events. Yeah, you know the situation, whether you or not you know these people.
Yeah, and I mean, there is like soap opera level like drama, like right from the beginning too, right? Because here's a wedding with a guy who is marrying his pregnant girlfriend, but he left his longtime lover, and now she's at the wedding,
yeah.
And she's, you know, so sorry, grandma, like, yeah. I failed you, and all, you know, so, like, this is, like, this kind of level of drama doesn't, like, normally, doesn't, like, happen, like, normally in life, and yet it all just feels, like, so, it's, it just feels so right. 400 Blows is another movie that I thought of, especially, like, in the school scenes, but also just in the way that, like, how does a movie about just some, like, French kid feel so universal, right? Well, because yeah. we were all that age at one point, right? Yeah, we've all been to a wedding, you know, we've all done these things. And it's just doing it in this way that just feels quietly profound, you know,
yeah.
even as it's not doing anything to necessarily call attention to itself, but it is just beautifully shot. Like, the camera never really moves. It pans. But there's no dollies or zooms that I can recall.
Yeah, a lot of, like, Asahiro Oshu, just kind of like a yeah. still. No movement shots.
Yeah, but also it's like...
His were much tighter.
The movement is within the frame. The yes. movement's not happening with the camera. The movement's happening either with tilting the camera so that the frame shifts or yeah. people and objects moving within the frame.
Or we're shooting from upstairs down on the floor below, like a lot yeah. of pulled way back, mm-hmm. but still not movement. There's not a grandness to it.
Yeah, it's interesting how some scenes are shot. They're shot in a way where the tension is caused by, like, what we can't see, but there's also mm-hmm. a certain amount of that kind of Renoir level empathy of, like, yeah. I'm thinking especially of the scene where we're not, and again, it's not really fully understood whether it is a suicide attempt or it's just someone who's very drunk, like, having an accident. But we think that a character has committed suicide, but all of this is, like, we don't see him. We just hear the girlfriend come in. We hear noises off screen. We hear her shouting. It's causing that tension because we can't see it. We don't,
yeah.
we're just like, oh shit, what's going
you
on?
You know, but the situation.
It's like, he's giving him maybe a little bit of, like, let's give a little dignity mm-hmm. here. You know what I mean? Like, he's Yang is, like, giving his characters a dignity that they don't necessarily always give each other.
Until, you know, the next shot, we see that guy just sprawled out nude on the bathroom floor.
That's what I mean. But even then, there's a minute of, like, are you dead? Like,
yeah.
he's not. Oh, no way, he's not dead. But he's fine. Yeah. But yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, again, and this is the brother-in-law of the family. The main family is dad, who is NJ.
Yeah.
Mom is Min Min, the daughter, who is, like, about 13, maybe 14. She's Ting Ting. And then the little boy who's 7 years old, 8 years old, something like that. He's Yang Yang.
Dude, I love you so much. You are so not a dad. That daughter is, like, obviously 17. The little boy is 6, maybe 7, or he's a small 8.
I have no clue what age anyone is, but whatever.
No children.
Whatever. She's a teenager and he's a child. That's the point.
Yes.
She's very shy, you know? I mean, yeah. I honestly love this character so much.
Me too.
She's so shy. She's so withdrawn. She's so racked with guilt about things that are so not her fault.
No.
But she's also, like, flush with hormones at the
yeah,
same time
and
with
teenager.
Envy. And there's one of the opening scenes is a family moving in, and there's a new girl. And she's, like, this is one of many doppelgangers
yeah.
throughout this movie. This new girl looks almost exactly like her. She looks maybe a year or two older, and she's, like, better at everything, right? She's got yeah. a boyfriend. She plays an instrument, but she's better. She's just a little more composed. She's more confident.
This her girl mom is very attractive and
yes.
Keeps herself looking great, whereas
yes.
Ting Ting's mom is just falling apart.
Absolutely.
And
but
abandons
then, of course,
the family.
We see how much of an illusion all of that, like, confidence is and
oh,
glamour
yeah.
and everything else, right? Like, it's and that's this movie. Like, it's just all of these, like, without pushing it, it's like, here's all these kind of things that are going on, like self versus selflessness, honesty versus lies, real thing, an authentic thing versus a fake thing, right? Yeah. And like, what they're just figuring out life. Like, what is the right thing to do? What is the honorable thing? What's loyal? What is this? What's good for me? What's good for them?
Yeah.
The mom just leaves. Right. Like, mom, okay, it's like the kind of inciting event is at the wedding, the grandmother comes home and she has a stroke while everyone's back at the wedding. She's left at home. And she's brought back into the house, and she's just sort of there in a coma.
For the majority of the movie, Ting Ting, the teenage daughter of NJ, feels like this is her fault.
Yeah.
Because she didn't take the garbage out. She assumes her grandmother did because that's where she was when she fell. Who knows, right? We don't know.
Right.
You don't see the event. You just get the second half. Meanwhile, one character... This is the brother-in-law who attempted suicide. He has been a shit son to her for obviously decades, borrowing money, never paying it back, embarrassing her. That all that stress way more contributed to this stroke.
And he feels no guilt for it.
And he can't even sit with her and talk to her.
No one can, really. And except that's for sort of a thing. Except for Ting Ting. Yeah, Ting Ting pours out her heart to her, but does it sort of in secret, right? It's kind of releasing her guilt. It's kind of like she's there. Grandma's there. She's in a coma. And it's like this sort of quietly omnipresent feeling of mortality that she brings to the household. I mean, it's all like it's right there, right? Everyone's seeing like this is what happens at the end.
Yep.
That stirs something in everybody in the household, right? Mom has a total emotional breakdown. She just thinks, what happens when it's my time to be there? I can't talk to her. She tries to get the little boy to talk to her. He can't do it either. Meanwhile, NJ, out of a pure coincidence, runs into an old lover at this wedding.
First love.
At the opening. He revisits that. Ting Ting, as we said, she's racked with guilt, but also is exploring these kind of hormones that are, you know, coming through and all of her desires. And then Yang Yang, the little boy, he's just sort of discovering the world. He's kind of like an enigma, I think, for most of this movie until the final scene, because we see him doing things and it's sort of like he's taking a picture.
Yeah.
And he'll say something kind of mercurial. And no one really understands what he's talking about, right? He's kind of quiet, but he's also like a bit of a troublemaker.
Yeah.
He's absolutely adorable, this kid. I mean, he's sort of the face of this movie.
It's just this shy of precocious movie kid. It dances that line.
That's what I'm
line.
Saying. I also forgot to mention, Ting Ting carries around a plant that won't bloom.
Yeah.
And it's a big thing about this plant that won't bloom. And like, you know, it's like, that shouldn't work. That should be heavy-handed and irritating, and
there's a scene where we have, and it's one of my favorite scenes, I think, because we actually see Ting Ting enter puberty. Like, we see this little boy the moment when he notices girls.
Yes.
And I thought, my dumbass thought it was an accident. So we see he's hiding from bullies. That's like his daily operation, run from the bullies. And he
Which are mostly
into,
girls.
exactly. And he ducks into a class where they're showing a movie and it's in the dark. Well, when he goes in, the kid gets his jacket caught on a nail that's on the side of the door. And I'm like, oh, that's just that they kept that in the take. You know, it's a very charming, real, innocent moment. And he goes in and hides. Then we see a girl who he has kind of focused on this girl a little bit before. She comes in there. And she's a little bit older than him, and her skirt gets caught on it, and you get a full underwear shot, which he does not shy away from looking at the entire time. And then the movie that they're showing in this class, storm clouds just start. That's all they're focusing on. And we're seeing the burgeoning awakening of his, like, oh, girls.
Well, and the narration is something about how, like, when opposites attract and this power that happens and this undeniable electrical charge, you know, like, it is just straight narrating his heart, you know, because he's seeing her in slow motion against his swirling clouds. Yeah.
She doesn't notice him at all. Nothing.
No.
It's just like, okay, This kid's growing up a little.
And that's, again, that's the level of where maybe it could have got to too cute. And the movie always seems to pull back and be a little more authentic. Because there is like this magical realism thing that kind of happens at the end of the movie with Grandma as well. And that's not done in any heavy-handed sort of way either, which is kind of amazing. But one of my favorite sequences, and where I think I turn from, wow, I'm really liking this, to, okay, this is like a canon level movie, is in this kind of final third here.
Ah.
There's this sequence where it's cutting back and forth between NJ, who is in Japan with his old lover, right? Yeah. Remember, mom just left.
Oh.
Mom's in a Buddhist monastery. So he meets up with his old, he takes this as like, okay, here's my shot. I ran into her. I'm going to call her. She pops, like, she lives in Chicago.
Yeah.
She pops, like, from Taiwan to Japan. That's not that, you know, it's a bit of a ride, but from, she just pops over from Chicago.
She's good to go.
To meet him.
Sorry. Oh,
yeah.
Leave this my American what, husband. I mean,
ready. She is right there. And so they have this whole thing where he abandoned her. This was first love. And as we find out, only love as far as he's concerned. Mm-hmm. And she's always kind of held a candle for him. She was devastated. They've never either gotten over it, even as they've gotten over it and had children and had other, you know, loves and wives and husbands and things. They've never gotten over it. Then it's also cutting back to Ting Ting and Fatty, where they're having their date, and they're kind of connecting as well, right? Like, they have the scene where they go to the movies and they talk about the movies, and they have the scene in the rain and all this kind of stuff. And it's just kind of like in a very like elegant sort of way, without being too slick, it kind of is going back and forth, and it's going between young lovers before a beginning and old lovers after an end.
Yeah,
right? Like, it's they're both outside of it. You know, they're both outside of it, and they have an opportunity to both kind of come back into it. And that's like, it's absolutely outstanding. It did make me think of In the Mood for Love.
Yeah.
A little bit. Some of those scenes towards the end of In the Mood for Love, where they're just kind of pouring their heart out to each other. Absolutely outstanding stuff. And then, man, gut punch of Sherry. I mean, which gut punch, right?
Yeah.
So many. But Sherry, I think, like, repeating NJ's betrayal, like, reliving it for him at the cost of her own happiness. I mean, that's just, like, and where they're both left at the end of it is, like, in this place of, like, kind of regret and this place of feeling, like, loss. And but it's, like, again, we have his Ting Ting's regret's just starting, whereas his regret is this eternal thing that is just never gonna die, you know.
Yeah.
And this didn't help, I'm sure. But I do think my favorite scene is the one towards the end with Ting Ting and grandma, where she dreams about her grandma, and she just has this vision of her smiling and happy, and grandma doesn't say anything, but she just lies down and finally is like, okay, I can sleep, because she hasn't been able to sleep this whole time. It's just, it's not affecting her decision making, I'm sure. And she just has this beautiful moment where she just says, like, you know, when you close your eyes, the world seems very beautiful. You know what I mean? Like, it's all so beautiful in your head. Everything's so wonderful. But then, you know, it's life disappoints you sometime. And so then there's the death and the bloom, and, you know, it's not heavy handed though. So,
yeah.
But then, like I said, this magical realism moment where she wakes up, she realizes while she was dreaming about this, that her grandma really did die, but she's holding this paper butterfly that her grandmother made for her in a dream. So it's pretty, pretty beautiful. And then we end with a funeral. Yang Yang's letter to grandma. He could finally talk to grandma.
And
it's just so good. It's really fantastic. No, I know. He's precocious on like a Jane Eyre sort of a level. You know, like, he is, it's so good though. And it just has so much amazing perspective of him being the youngest one. And, you know, I'm like, this tie between like young kids and grandparents, you know, young kids and old people, you know, this whole circle, and him feeling like what he really wants to tell her is that now that he has a baby brother, he feels old. You know, it's so great. Like, it's really wonderful. And that's it. That's Yi Yi.
Yeah.
Rick, what about you? Do you have a favorite scene, sequence, shot?
A bunch of things. So it's a 3-hour movie, and we could not have gone through this thing linearly. We just discussed the themes and some of the key moments, but I found myself struck all the time by how beautiful each shot was. No matter, like, there's a scene where NJ goes out on the wharf by himself and the waves are crashing around. That can't help but be pretty, right? The way that is set up. But it's just as pretty with him in his very middle-income house, cluttered with stuff, darkened, you know, just the pall of kind of death and loneliness hanging over it. And it's almost like Michael Corleone in Tahoe, you know, where it's dark and the, but not as tastefully appointed, right? It's just
right? The middle class version.
It's just as pretty, right? There's when I first was like audibly go, oh shit, in this movie, is when I got what it was doing with the whole people don't see things the way you see them, and that's really tied up at the end with the kid with the camera. In the beginning, at the wedding, they have a picture of the bride and groom, and he puts it on the easel, and it's upside down. Like he doesn't see that he put it upside down. He just put it upside down because he did it from behind. And then that's like, I'm catching, okay, there's something going on. A little bit later, the brother comes over to ask for money and ducks around a corner in the elevator lobby when like a confrontation happens and nobody knows he's there. So nobody has any idea that that guy ever was there to hear that. And it's not like a plot point or anything. It doesn't drive anything, but it's just like, nobody will know what you know unless you know, because they can't see it the same way. But when I got it, it's when Ting Ting is the teenager. Is it Ting Ting or Ying Ying?
Yeah.
Okay, Ting Ting. She is talking to her neighbor's ex-boyfriend now, and he's still hanging around because he talks to her about his ex-girlfriend, but he's crushed, he's forlorn, and she's trying to like talk to him like a friend, and this other couple walks by and it was like, oh man, she is cruel to him. And it's like, that was just a passersby comment, because to them it looks like she's breaking up with him or she's the one, but they don't know the whole story. Nobody knows the whole story. So everything you ever see of a brief interaction, you don't know anything about that except for the surface level that you interpret it as.
Right. Yeah. And you're bringing your own thing to it. Yeah.
It's all tied up.
No, that's great. Do you
remember that part?
Oh, yeah. That's a great, great, great point.
And it's all tied up at the end with why we see Ying Ying walking around with his camera all the time, taking pictures, and he's taking pictures of a lot of things, and he gets his film done during class. He runs out. I love that part. He runs out of class, literally runs across the street to go get film developed. And then we see he takes a lot of pictures of the back of people's heads. And it's because, you know, you'll never see that part of you. You physically can't. But that, I went back and I like noticed how much of this movie you see the back of people's heads, whether you're in the backseat of a car while they're driving, whether it's like the wife and NJ having their first like honest conversation in a while, and she's her reflection, you can see the back of her head. So much of that is back of people's heads. And that's, like you said, the self-referential nature. I think he's saying, I was Ting Ting. Edward Yang is saying, that's me. That's the way I'm trying to show it. And then here's me grown up. There's another great one where it's almost like three mirrors when NJ's alone on his work trip, and they're telling him, come back, don't seal the deal that you just sealed. And he's just sitting there like, is this my fucking life? And on the foot of the bed, you don't see the front of him, but you just see the back of him, and it's done in two, like, reflection of a reflection. It's like Inception levels. Of point of view. It's just masterful.
It is something that seems so simple and yet is complex and layered on levels that we don't even think about. Yeah. Heck of a movie. Corky, I think I know the answer to this, but let's just remind everybody, just to make it all legal. This is boilerplate, but we raid on the slider sound system. If we both thought it was sound, into the can, fodder can, and it goes. One of both of us thought it was a little slide, then we make another movie.
This is the part when you're getting into the app, you have to click that you accept the terms. You trust that people won't sell your information. Even though you don't really trust it.
I don't say this, none of this is legal. But Corky, the question to you, slight or sound? Yee yee.
Oh, yeah, fucking sound is a yee yee. It's so sound.
Yeah.
Can I get a sounder yee-yee? Than the Seattle Sounders, who just won the League's Cup.
Congratulations to the Seattle Sounders. Sounder than the 1972 Best Picture nominee Sounder, starring Cicely Tyson.
Sounder than the soundtrack to the movie Sounder by Taj Mahal.
I agree. Sound, no doubt. Excited to watch more Edward Yang films. This was my first one. This was a big one for a long time.
I would already be watching that other one if it wasn't on the list, and it might come up. I'd already be going on to it.
Yeah. 235 minutes, but, we'll find time for it. Speaking of finding time, here we go, Corky. It's time of the show. Time for us to summon those random number generator gods and ask them to pick a number.
Are they random?
List, and then...
I swear to God, if the next one is Shiny Happy Place or whatever the fuck that movie's called, it's going to be crazy.
A brighter summer day, Happy Place. That's great. So what do you got for us? Random number generator gods. They have chosen for us. Oh, Corky, this is exciting. You actually, I think we're talking about this movie.
Okay. Well, Dan, don't
I was talking about this movie. A little film called Pather Panchali.
Oh! By our
good buddy Satyajit Ray of Charulata.
Okay.
Fame. That's the first film in the Apu trilogy from 1955, written and directed by Satyajit Ray. His first film. Tell you the letterbox synopsis. Impoverished priest Harihar Ray leaves his rural Bengal village in search of work. His wife Sarbajaya looks after their rebellious daughter Durga and young son Apu. The children enjoy the small pleasures of their difficult life. Corky, you've never seen this film?
Never, but it sounds very slice of lifey.
Oh boy, yeah. This is the 1955 Indian Yee is what this is. Another family drama, kid right at the center there. Fantastic movie. One of my all-time favorites. Excited to watch it again.
We canonized Charulata.
If you
want to
play along at home. We sure did.
Yeah.
We sure did. And I threw up World of Apu, I think it was, for something. I think it was India Song, maybe?
Yeah, okay.
Slighted film. That was the third film in the trilogy. But they're all on Criterion Collection. If you don't have Criterion, it's also HBO Max, Canopy, Plex. You can watch it with ads on Tubi. It's to rent on all your usual VOD services. Not hard to find this film. It's 125 minutes. Very digestible. And I think it's a great kind of maybe even life-changing sort of movie. One of those sort of films. So highly recommend it if you haven't seen the film.
That's what we thought about Yee Yee. What did you think about Yee Yee? Did you watch it with us? Had you seen it before? We would honestly love to hear your take. Contact us on, because you can't see it the way we saw it. You literally can't. That's the whole fucking point of the movie. And if you don't recognize that, I don't want to hear from you. Actually, I do. Tell me I'm wrong. Daniel would love to hear your take. I'm saying don't talk to me. Daniel's saying talk to him. Contact us on Facebook and Instagram.
I'm saying talk to Corky.
And Dear
talk
Daniel Pod.
To Corky.
Tell us your thoughts. Dan takes great pains to write these scripts, and I fuck them all up. Until then, follow Dear Daniel Pod on Facebook and Instagram. Like and rate us on your favorite podcast app. If you'd like to donate to the show, visit daredaniel.com. Find support the show in the menu, or look for the donate button. For Cannon Fodder, I'm Cork McDonald.
And I'm Daniel Barnes saying save us a seat in the back row.